A different future starts with you. That's why GoDaddy does more than help you find a name. You can create, sell, and get found online, so any small business could be a driving force to create change or build an empire. We know old ideas aren't cutting it anymore, so we're calling for a new generation of thinking, your way of thinking. So whatever you have in mind that will help make a different future, find everything you need to get started at GoDaddy.com. Because the future isn't decided yet. It's up to us to make it happen. Start different at GoDaddy.com.
If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalit.org today.
This is an ode to Napa cabbage. Of all the cabbages on all the cabbage farms, only you have the crisp crunch worthy of our Bibigo Korean dumplings. No other cabbage would do, because no other cabbage tastes like you. We love you, Napa cabbage. Just don't tell Green Onion. Napa cabbage, one of many obsessively crafted ingredients in every hearty, flavorful Korean dumpling from Bibigo. Go handcrafted. Go Bibigo. Authentic Korean dumplings now in the freezer aisle.
This is Podco Media Networks.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Hi, it's Mark Garnett. What's happening today?
Oh, not too much. How you doing? What's the weather like on the East Coast?
It's dark. It's 5:04 p.m. here, and it got dark about 20 minutes ago. So I don't know what the weather's like outside. I think it's probably in the 40s or 50s or something like that. I don't know. It's 55 degrees here.
Well, don't worry. The sun will come out after Biden is declared the winner.
Yeah, we should say that we are recording this on Wednesday, November 4th. It's gonna go on the network sometime after that, but it's been an interesting day to try and get work done.
Yeah, that's right. And I've talked to a lot of people today who are claiming to be, quote, tired and, quote, exhausted and, quote, worn out. I guess they were up late watching the returns and all that stuff. So,
yeah.
So,
well, anyway,
I did not stay up late watching the returns. So
I stayed up until about midnight and then I went to bed and checked my phone first thing in the morning. But, you know, it is what it is, right? It's happening. And I voted, you voted, we voted. That's what you do.
Well, I wrote myself in. I voted for myself.
Oh, did you?
No.
I would vote for you. Not for president, but maybe for something else.
For like what? Like pack leader or like den mother or something. Something like that.
Anyway, we have a wonderful guest on the show today. I'll hand it over to you to introduce her.
Today, we are so lucky to have Jacqueline Bouvier Copeland, or I'm just going to say Jackie from here on in because that's a mouthful. Hi, Jackie.
Hi there. Jackie's good for me.
Okay, hi, Jackie. Good.
So I'm not even going to pretend to like know all of the nuances of her long, varied, and successful career that led her to where she is now and the stuff we're going to talk about. But I'll tell you what I know, and then maybe we'll use that as a segue into the first question about Jackie's background. I know that you've been in nonprofit for some years. I know that I think you've been in education. You know you have a PhD at the end of your title, and you were COO of AnitaB.org, a very well-known women in technology nonprofit. And now you're an investor, an impact investor, and you're dragging LPs and angel investors, individual investors into the future. And I won't steal any thunder from that. We'll talk about that later on in the podcast. Is that a fair representation of at a very high level, Jackie? And welcome.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's pretty fair.
Okay.
Been around for a while and been working in different sectors, trying to make a difference for everybody. So thanks to you and Mark for hosting me.
Thanks for coming.
So that good to have you here.
That's the perfect segue. So we always want to hear the backstory. We always want to hear what people did to get them to this point in time where they're doing the wonderful things that they're doing and trying to move the needle on the big changes that they're trying to change. So could you give us a couple of minutes about your background, or as long as you want, really?
Okay, I'll try and do a thumbnail sketch of it. But basically, I'm one of those people who lived through a lot of the challenges in the world at a personal level. And very early on in life, decided that I wanted to try and figure out how to make life easier for other people so they wouldn't have to experience what I experienced. And so grew up in Philly. I'm lucky to be born into a family with a mom in particular who believed that education, as much as I could get, was my ticket towards great things and out of poverty. Her motto used to be, she had three kids and she used to tell us, you will be educated if I have to pour it down your throat.
I think I heard something like that along the way.
You always wondered if you got bad grades that mom would actually pin you down and pour the education down your throat. It was a really strong motivator. And they're always interested in kind of that nexus between business and society. Grew up in a neighborhood where I remember the manufacturing jobs in Philly disappearing, and then seeing families on the blocks in the Northwest Philly neighborhood where I grew up in kind of break apart. Dad's out of work, mom's trying to get work, families breaking up. You could actually get on the subway or the regional train and see factories just closed. They're still closed to this day. And that was almost, 50 years ago. And, you know, saw what happened when mostly service economy jobs were available. And I felt like there were all these forces that I couldn't name or see that were determining the everyday life of people. And just always had sort of this almost scholarly curiosity to understand what was happening and why, and then on a practical side, how I could do something about it. So I got on this dual education track that ultimately led to an urban design master's, a cultural anthropology master's, and PhD, because I wanted to be able to promote change. And I didn't have the word for it, but I would call it equity and justice now. For everybody worldwide and throughout the country. I had the good fortune when I was at University of Pennsylvania to work for a think tank at the Wharton School to help fund my education. That became like a practicum.
What was the name of that think tank, just out of curiosity?
It's called the Organization and Management Group.
Nice.
They have a new name now because they spun off and became their own entity. But that was in early 80s, and I had foundations throughout the world as clients. And I used to design and evaluate their community development and anti-poverty programs. One thing led to another. And in my mid-20s, I started working as a foundation executive. I would still teach at the university level, always that connection between knowledge production and new knowledge and innovation and practical application of it. So kind of a classic advocate scholar in that sense, in and out of academia, because I really like to take the knowledge and make it real and try to make real change in collaboration with other people. A lot of work in diversity, equity, and inclusion. Founded all kinds of organizations working on social justice and equity and finance issues, multiple foundations, social enterprises, social investment organizations, always with an eye towards inclusion and working nationally and globally, written several books and some articles along the way. And most recently segued from Anita B. Anita Borg Institute for Women in Technology to creating an enterprise called Women Invested to Save Earth Fund, which is finding underfunded Black and Indigenous women climate change innovators throughout the world, trying to fund them at even a pre-development stage, and working with a range of brilliant people to get them in-kind support and advice so they can act as feeders to the large social investment and VC funders. I just feel like there's so much kind of convergence of systems breakdown that the world can't afford to leave people with good ideas out. They may be the persons, people who make a big difference for global warming or cure cancer. I mean, it's just an all hands on deck moment for the planet.
That's a great way of looking at it. I want to drill down on a phrase that I have always found fascinating, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but it's the phrase cultural anthropologist or cultural anthropology. And the thing that has always fascinated me about, I know two other people who have used that to describe themselves or in their title or on their bio or CV. One person went in the direction of learning and training, like for big corporations. And she literally has a PhD in cultural anthropology or some aspect of it. And the other person went in the direction of designing interfaces for humans and computers.
Yep.
And I guess what fascinates me about it is the breadth of applicability or the relevance of it across so many areas of human endeavor. Can you just share with the audience a little bit about just what it is, what the definition is, why it was interesting to you, and what direction you're taking that in?
Yeah, so I was probably a cultural anthropologist as a youngster before I even had that term. I didn't have any exposure to it immediately, except for I remember going on a field trip to the University of Pennsylvania has a great museum that houses the anthropology department. And I was just fascinated. They had a great collection of mummies and artifacts from ancient Egypt and other and the Middle East. And I just was fascinated with the notion of who we are now is somehow related to history from millennia ago, and that there were all these different cultures and languages. And, you know, how could you really get people to understand and respect each other based on where they come from and their heritage, and respecting those differences, but at the same time, respecting the fact that we're all just human beings, we're one species. So as a youngster, I used to collect stories from people. We were a storytelling family. So you've probably heard of ethnography and people like Margaret Mead, who collect stories and write them with an eye to helping people who are not from a particular cultural background understand the worldview of different societies from their own perspective.
So when you were a kid, you were like a baby griot.
my family is from, on my mom's side, from the South. And telling stories and character from, that are passed down through generations was actually a form of entertainment. We didn't have a lot of money growing up, but I could always go downtown where there were all kinds of characters who I vividly remember today. And just talking to them about their story, it fascinated me, really.
Cultural ancient tradition.
Yeah, cultural anthropologists study the history and culture of humanity throughout time. And we try to promote intercultural understanding and respect, and almost see cultural diversity as a resource. We never know where the best idea is going to come from unless we're respecting and open to the different worldviews and lived experiences that diverse people bring. And so that comparative historical study of the development and evolution of culture, I specialize in something called social change, identity, and diasporas, how you pick up how people throughout history pick up their culture from one place and transplant it into another to create a new culture. So I am a culture geek. I am a humanist. I want to use culture to help people build bridges, understand each other's culture, produce new knowledge, and promote human rights. And so there are many ways to do that. For example, throughout my career, I've worked mostly in social justice and social change, but I've helped design many things, including a private island for a cruise company. I have designed various programs and products from non-interest-based mortgages for religious minorities that have prohibitions against paying interest in their doctrine. Of course, studying philanthropy, immigrant and diaspora philanthropy, how to grow the social sector and finance it, different cultural approaches to doing that. And so I look for the implicit biases, the innovative techniques in any human endeavor. And anthropologists just have different specialties. It's probably the most interdisciplinary of all the social science fields. Many of us teach it and apply it to solve problems in the real world.
So I'm not going to let you off the hook on that private island thing. I'm coming back to that.
But I heard that and I knew Garnett would be all over
it. You are not getting away from giving me the proper explanation and painting the picture on how that came about. That's just too good. That's almost too good to be true.
That's juicy, huh?
I'm going to throw away the rest of the questions, and I just want to talk about
that.
But I do have a quick side story that you're going to love. When you and I first met, I told you the story of my mom coming, being a South Asian Indian woman whose family emigrated to the Caribbean and was part of that diaspora. And, they were not untouchables, but they were lower caste family on my mother's side versus my father's side, which is a little bit more aristocratic, as a professor and all this. But, my mom, when I was at Columbia as a scholarship kid, she certainly couldn't afford to pay for Columbia. One of my professors who taught some sort of like crappy intro to anthropology survey course or whatever, Columbia has the core curriculum. So you have to kind of take whatever the hell they tell you, right, for the first two years. So he was doing some independent research for his publication requirements. And I told him what I told you about my mom and, her experience, going from one culture to the next and being in a family of 13 and, the education imperative or the challenge for the female, for her sisters to be, educated properly, because traditional Hinduism doesn't, at that level anyway, didn't really appreciate that opportunity for women. Right. When he heard about this, he insisted. He drove from Manhattan out to Long Island, where I grew up, and interviewed my mom for like 8 hours and created an oral history of my mom and her family and going all the way back. And he used a word which I have always loved, and it's a real geek SAT word. But he said her life, and really you could apply this to anyone who lives that diaspora experience, was a palimpsest. And the more that she peeled back, it was like an onion skin. The more that she talked about it, the more layers got peeled back and the richness of that really global cultural experience that she lived and internalized came out in this like epic oral history, 8 hours of recording. That's crazy.
It's a core tenet of good anthropology, and I want to say that because there, anthropologists have some baggage with colonialism, et cetera, but there's a whole generation of us who are very aware of it, whose families or ancestors were oppressed by it, but one of the inherent powers of every human being is their story. And I believe, probably like many cultural anthropologists, that every individual creates history every day in some way, even if they're not aware of it. And part of what I try to do is to help people recognize the power of their story, no matter where they were born, whether they're wealthy or not, that human story is valuable and is the basic building block of history, economy, society, and life. And so the whole oral history technique, which has certain questions that you ask, et cetera, is a way to give life and visibility and empower the individual stories that drive human history and evolution.
Well, the other thing I learned from this particular professor who had two surnames, he had a hyphenated surname, is that the more educated you are...
That's so pretentious.
the more educated you are, the more surnames you have or are entitled to have.
So, well, I don't know about that.
I'm privileged. I feel privileged to be on a podcast with two people who have two surnames versus,
well,
you know.
I only have one now, but, you know, I kind of respect whatever the naming traditions are of societies and cultures. So in many African societies, a child is not given their name until the family can organize some sort of naming ceremony. And then they have several names that kind of presage what the family believes can be their destiny and their identity, but also the family's history. So my daughter, whose biological father is Nigerian, actually has five names. And each one of those names is loaded with her history and what we felt was her destiny. There are many women who want to just keep all of their names when they marry. So they have their father's name and then their husband's name. And as you know, in many Latino cultures, the mom's name becomes the middle name and the father's name is the last name.
Plus the six Catholic names they got.
Right. And that's all. And that's what the whole idea is, that one name can't contain their full identity and history. And so names are really fascinating if we look at them from the perspective of the culture or the family or the person who's created the name. Just tell you a lot about the history and the culture. So I tend not to prejudge them. I use that as an opportunity to, you know, find out how people see their identity and how it's connected to their heritage. There are some people who are taking part of the husband's last name and the wife's maiden name and creating a whole new last name for their family. So it's pretty fascinating, actually, naming conventions.
I'm really conflicted right now because there's part of me that wants to, like, try to skewer Mark for his 30 last names. And then there's part of me that just cannot let you off the hook for that private island story. So can you tell me, can you resolve my conflictedness and let's go on to the private island story? How on earth did that ever come about?
Well, so I specialize in anthropology in something called social and culture theory. And they're all of these complex theories about what culture is, how it evolves, what social structure is, et cetera. And so I can't remember the name of this cruise company. I did this when I was fresh out of graduate school and I had this unique background as a trained designer who could design places and products. And they had a very international market base. And this company was developing a private island into not just an amusement park, like a community.
Where was it? Where was it? The Caribbean somewhere?
Yeah, it was in the Caribbean. Okay. And so they didn't know social and culture theory And the project lead had a PhD in rhetoric, but he knew there was something in social and culture theory that would help him create the conceptual framework for this island with his group of architects and designers. And so I basically did a curriculum for him and his staff and trained them quickly in the basics of cultural and social theory and created a framework for them. This was with a big design firm that had the contract to develop this island for this cruise company. And this is right before user experience became an actual field.
I was going to say, this sounds like experience of what's now called experience design, right?
Right. That's what it's called now, but it was just called design at the time because like 20, 25 years ago. I mean, it's not something, not a field that I wanted to stay in, but it was an interesting exercise in how to work with full-time designers. And so, and I never wanted to lose the ability to design places and experiences for people, which is a part of my social change practice right now.
So what in your background, or which maybe more than one, I don't know, what do you think of all the experiences that you've shared with us and the audience? Can you single out one or two things that you would consider a seminal and life-changing, you know, that sort of encapsulated everything that you've become now and are hoping to achieve with some of the things we're going to talk about soon, like the Wise Fund?
I would actually have to start way back. My entire childhood and having to struggle to make
it. Go for it.
Yeah, I mean, that whole experience of struggling, dealing with, you know, some level of poverty, learning about philanthropy from the oldest cousin in the family who told me, you know, if you get A's, people you don't even know will give you money. They call them scholarships so that you can actually go to college and even beyond. I remember learning that. It's like, these are all I have to do is get A's and And so once I found that out, I was like, done. I will do that and I will get money. And that's what happened. And I think that was a little revolutionary to me because there was no reason for those people to care. They didn't even know me. It was usually just like a paper application. And my family, even though they didn't have a lot, they gave a lot of what they had. So just that whole experience of giving just because it's a good thing to do when you want to help someone else and my sense of obligation that I had to do that with others. Giving either time, talent, treasure, or voice. That's still a core part of who I am, and I am paying it forward. And I know I feel like that's the reason, even though I had no money, I got all the opportunities that I had is because then I had the ability to help others, and that's at the backdrop of everything I do. Then maybe 20 years ago, I started working in the entire field of, it's now called diaspora philanthropy. And I founded something called Black Philanthropy Month, which is now engaged 18 to 20 million people and is recognized by the UN and 30 government bodies in its celebration of Black giving and funding worldwide. It culminates in August of each year. And we have now, just this past August, all of the participants during a 4-day high-tech virtual global convening that probably directly engaged 2,000 people have created the first ever global Black funding equity principles and a pledge for funders worldwide to take. There are about 10 principles that they've been signing on to that we think in the Black philanthropy or Black funding equity movement will promote more equity and impact, especially now that many corporations are working on racial equity issues. And I'm very proud that 40 countries have participated in this effort, and it continues to grow. Then in about the mid-2000s, somebody from the Ford Foundation, a man named Lauren Harris, commissioned me to design a national fund to support equity for low-income Black men and boys. And I created it, and it was called My Brother's Keeper. And so then that was like 2006 or seven. Then I learned a couple of years later that the Obama administration had picked it up. And I think you've heard that he created a signature initiative called My Brother's Keeper that I later learned was based on the design, in part on the design that I did for the Ford Foundation. So when your dream is to make social change, and, you know, frankly, this was a proprietary piece of research. And so I wasn't in a position, it was owned by the Ford Foundation. So I wasn't sharing it or anything, but I was just really proud that they thought in the administration that it was good enough to inform their effort, which continues at the Obama Foundation. So yeah, the things that matter to me most, even though I've been fortunate to raise a lot of money in my different jobs, are those instances where I know that I have been part of an effort that managed to make a difference on the issues, the barriers that I had to overcome as a youngster, which I know affect many people in the U.S. and throughout the world. And so, you know, that's how, in part how I, and of course, becoming a mom, if I could say that, I mean, really just becoming a parent in some ways further intensifies this drive to make the world better than you found it, if for your children and other next generation people.
COVID-19 patients need your help.
If you've fully recovered from COVID-19
or unknowingly been exposed to it,
you may have the antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients recover.
Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies.
Visit Vitalant.org today to schedule an appointment to donate blood.
That's Vitalant.org. Help save lives and schedule your appointment at Vitalant.org.
You could help save lives.
Let's dig deep into the WISE Fund and the various initiatives unfolding now, all the way up to the global investing principles that I just read about recently. So give us some backstory on the WISE Fund, because it feels like the WISE Fund is, based on your generous sharing of the backstory all the way back to childhood and the principles that came out of that, it feels like the WISE Fund, when I read the sort of about section on the website, it feels like the logical culmination of your upbringing, cultural anthropology, education, the various work experiences that you've had, all married to, you know, essentially concern for the planet and the future of the planet.
Definitely. And you hit the nail right on the head. Absolutely. So the time it became clear to me that I needed to do something that bridged all of these concerns and experiences, when I was on assignment for Anita Borg Institute, July of last year, we did our first, I still say we did our first major women's tech conference with Australian women technologists in Brisbane. And as I typically do, especially when I'm going to a country or a continent for the first time, I try to just travel and see the signature places and just spontaneously meet people, talk to them, really get an inside out flavor for the place in true, I guess, anthropologist fashion. And so one of the places I went to really struck me too, the Great Barrier Reef. And then close to the Great Barrier Reef is actually the world's oldest continuous rainforest. I didn't know it was there, called Coranda. And I took a gondola tour of this rainforest and attended some lectures, touring lectures with a naturalist there. And he was explaining,
you know, you and the gondola is like the it operates in the trees, right? Is that how that works?
Yep, it was okay. Wonderful. And this one had a glass floor, and so in the gondola, you saw a whole tree canopy. There are these tree kangaroos, which I didn't know existed, and in fact, this particular
tree kangaroo,
Australia is a special place. This particular forest inspired Avatar, the movie by James Cameron.
Yeah.
And so at some point it is like there are these cloud islands in the sky. You have to see it to truly experience it. And I noticed that the indigenous youth couldn't get jobs anywhere there. They were kind of just hanging out on the corners. You know, some drinking, some out of school. And then when I went to the Pacific Ocean and the Great Barrier Reef, close to this forest, I asked the tour guide, why is half of the ocean brown? And he explained that there was logging around the rainforest, and the erosion and runoff was helping to kill the coral. That it wasn't all global warming. It was the actual pollution of the ocean from overlogging. And I saw the coral, which, you know, you expect the vibrant colors, and they were bleached. They just looked like skeletons.
Like a ghost land, right?
Yeah, honestly. And then I went home, came back to the U.S. a few days later, and then the whole continent was burning. I think you must remember those mega fires that were happening. And I was really inspired, engaged by the place and its people. And it just put on my mind, and it kind of flashed me back to the very polluted community I grew up in Philly, where people had high rates of asthma and all other kinds of diseases, and how there was this disproportionate impact of environmental decline and toxicity and global warming on the indigenous people of Australia in particular. And so I just couldn't shake it. This was even before COVID, et cetera. From July, August of last year, you need to figure out how to do something, because part of working with the Anita Borg Institute is you meet thousands of brilliant technical women of all backgrounds across the world who cannot get equal funding, no matter how, you know, often they're deeply educated, qualified, have great ideas. But as you know, funding to women entrepreneurs, especially women of color, is about 1% of VC funding. And so all of these concerns and ideas were coming together. And I said, what if the power and the brilliance and the drive of women, particularly from communities that are most affected by the global warming and climate change consequences that I witnessed and experienced as a child, but didn't know what was happening, and then was experiencing again in Australia and parts of Africa where I've worked, and certainly in the contemporary US. And really, what can you do about it with your network, your social capital and financial capital and community will? And so that was the birth of the WISE Fund. It was actually created in early March just of this year. I was supposed to do the global debut of the WISE Fund at the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. I think it was the 63rd anniversary this year. And then COVID happened. And on March 13th, the quarantines actually started. So I was unable to fly to New York to launch this with the Brazil Foundation, which is a key partner. But we did it virtually. And the mission of the WISE Fund is to identify, well, first of all, to promote funding equity, There's no reason that people with all of the money in the world, you know, just $21 trillion in social investment alone worldwide, that we shouldn't be giving all good ideas, no matter what human package they come in, a fair shot. There's no excuse for it, and the world needs it. And so
can you tell folks what WISE the acronym stands for?
Sure. Women Invested to Save Earth.
Love it.
Yeah, which actually, you know, really I was pondering and troubled by this question of what are you going to do? You have the privilege and frankly blessing to be in all these different places and see these challenges and have connections with the potential innovators who can help us solve them. So what are you going to do? So I was working on the WISE Fund. I had launched it. I had a bit of money to fund. In September, we funded our first group of innovators. Very exciting group. And if you want to talk about that more later, I'm happy to talk about them.
Absolutely.
We've been the primary backer of the Black Philanthropy Month and Funding Equity Pledge Initiative, and actually act as the back office in part because I'm the founder of both efforts. And so we've been doing a whole range also of seminars. We have an initiative called Reunity, which is a peer network and capacity building initiative for women funders and innovators. And we continue to support in any way that we can. We are going to start an alternative finance institute focused on social investment and carbon offsets and other forms of funding that communities that are underfunded could access but need to know more about. And then also the leaders in those funding sectors often don't have good connections to diverse innovators. And we're hoping to be a bridge between the two and just increase the technical and diversity IQ of both sides. And so we're excited to launch that as well.
And for folks who want to participate either philanthropically or as investors, you can go to, it's the WISE, W-I-S-E, fund, all one word, .org, right?
That's right. Or contact me directly at give@thewisefund.org. We are in the midst of a fundraising campaign, philanthropic and investment, social investment as well, to support the various initiatives that I referenced. Our WISE Innovator Award Program, which identifies climate change makers across the world, particularly in Black and Indigenous communities, and provides them support. The Alternative Finance Institute, as well as our other efforts. We have some cutting edge initiatives in development as well, and we're looking for partners.
And so if you're out in the listening audience, if you're a law firm, there are ways to work with the WISE Fund that could be mutually beneficial. If you are a corporation looking to use, you know, proceeds from your corporate foundation or through sponsorship there are multiple ways for entities and organizations to connect with and support the WISE Fund. Is that correct?
Yeah, certainly philanthropy. We very much would like that support, but also in-kind support. Many of the organizations we work with need help with the patent process. For experienced managers, there's a whole range of other capacity building support that our startups could use. In addition, we're looking for social investors and VCs who are very committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion with an interest in climate change issues, whereby we could act as a feeder system for them, because we do have this remarkable network of organizations that we are supporting that could produce not only impact, social and environmental, but have very high potential for producing financial returns as well.
And I think that last piece is something that may be good alignment with Aperture, our diversity fund, for those organizations that you back that have a social impact that are, let's say, scaling in the U.S. market. We may end up having some good fit there. So, you know, you and I are going
to... We'd love to talk about it. It's actually my next agenda item for you and William. It's just like, we need so many agenda items. Ooh. I try to space them out, you know.
It's all good. We have what's left of our lifetime, you know, to work through the process. So,
okay.
I just want to ask one question. Before we started recording, we were talking about the fact that you're in Arizona and you went and looked at the Grand Canyon, which is amazing and kind of hard to actually think is actually real. And you also did a bit of a First Nations tour of Walnut Canyon and saw these apartments that are built into kind of the side of a hill, a mountainside, up at 7,000 feet. And I'm just wondering what you learn from something like that, and maybe even seeing the Barrier Reef and, and all that, that you bring to your kind of professional life every day and how that informs you.
Well, you can probably tell from a little bit of the life story that I shared, I am just really inspired and have almost a childlike sense of wonder at the ingenuity, creativity, and resilience of humanity throughout time. And being exposed to that, different places, different people, is part of my personality. And no matter what's going on in the world, it gives me a sense of hope that people working together, given all that humanity has been through in so many different ways, that we can address climate change, that we can promote real diversity, equity, and inclusion. These are actually not the most complicated things that humanity has done. So it's really important for me to keep my energy up, to be exposed to innovative ideas and actually learn how ancient people managed, indigenous people, to do such amazing things with simple tools.
Right.
And ways we can live in better balance with the planet. What I didn't mention to you is that the reason I'm in Arizona is in part my mother, who has a variety of health issues, lives with me in California. And the smoke from the fires got so bad that she was getting sick and I was getting sick. And ironically, I work on climate change issues, right? And so I had to move her out. I'm blessed that I had the wherewithal to do that. She's on the East Coast with my siblings. And I'm in Arizona in part so I could recover from some of the respiratory issues I was developing. Sure. Just because it wasn't just one fire, they were back to back and really severe. At some point, I could sit in my living room and see the embers from one of the more recent fires, which was in Napa and Sonoma counties. I could see them over the hillside and just sit there and watch the smoke. Even with all these air purifiers I had in my house come into my living room. And, you know, instead of getting depressed or upset, I not only left, but I said, you know what? This is the way the universe affirming that what I'm trying to do with the WISE Fund is important. And I hope now, if only the California example, where, you know, smoke was in the living rooms of people in the Bay Area. We were worried about the impact on our children and our elders, and we're already quarantined largely because of COVID. And I had this mask that looked like something from World War II when I had to go to the supermarket or a pharmacy. And so I was pushed out because of climate change, at least for a time, as things have calmed down now because it's not as hot and the rain should be coming soon. But California or, you know, these kinds of major climate disasters are coming to Americans and everywhere else very soon if they haven't experienced them all over. So I consider this an emergency. I want to stay connected to the people who are being impacted. And now I'm one of those people. And we really cannot continue the status quo and expect that we will be able to sustain the natural environment, which is the basis of our market, of production, of profitable businesses. If we were somehow to magically achieve equity and social justice tomorrow, it would be a really hollow victory if the very planet that sustains us is dying. And that's what's happening. And so it's the reason I can wake up every day. So I have these lived experiences. At the same time, I come in contact with historical sites and, you know, everyday people and technologists who have great ideas, and we need to get them supported and to market so we can scale them and accelerate their impact, because we're just at a really critical crossroads as a human species.
The website again for the WISE Fund is the WISE, W-I-S-E, fund, all one word, .org. And hey, Mark, before we kick it over to you for the outro, I think I know what we should call this episode as far as either the main title or the stuff that comes after the colon. It is something that Jackie said earlier in this that's just reverberating in my brain. Time, talent, treasure, and voice. Pick your contribution and do something. Is that a fair summary,
Jackie? Yeah, everybody can do something. And each of those ways of contributing to me are a form of funding. And if you really peel back a layer of the onion of every successful social change or environmental change movement throughout human history, they had those four components. And the extent to which you can get diverse people of all means and all backgrounds involved, that is how you create transformation that has a long shelf life. So I do encourage everyone to remember the importance of addressing climate change in your everyday life, in your political decisions, and how you spend your money as a consumer, and also how you fund organizations as a donor and investor. It is the common denominator of humanity. It's the foundation we need to keep intact, even just for our children to have a better life than we have.
Well, Jackie, this has just been such an enlightening and wonderful discussion. It was wonderful having you here.
Well, thank you for having me, sharing part of my life story. And I was telling Garnett the other day, this is quite new for me. I'm a very private person, but I just am so driven and committed to this issue. I feel like I need to share all of who I am and everything I've got to make a difference with others.
Oh, you're very good at it. So if you're new to this, you have mastered it.
Oh, well, I don't usually talk to broad audiences in this way. That's what's new. But I talk this way to my family and close colleagues all the time. So Thank you for giving me a platform. I hope I've inspired somebody, because we really need to work together on these issues.
Yep. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you for having me, and have a good day.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit theinnovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.